time for the Bible reading now. We're going to continue in Mark. And today the reading is Mark 9, starting at the Spirit. Came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd among them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the boy saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer."
Thanks, Fiona. There is a sermon outline available. I'm going to give you a moment to stand, have a stretch, sit down again if you need to do that, and then we'll get into it. So yeah, if you could have that part of Mark chapter 9 in front of you, that would be really helpful for you and for me. This is really a unique miracle, and it's different to the healings and the spiritual deliverance that Jesus had performed earlier. This is told in a very different way. You know, a healing miracle would usually result in people's amazement and wonder at Jesus, but this time the conclusion isn't quite the same. And so we've been heading for Jerusalem with Jesus in these chapters. And this section is actually bookended with two other miracle stories. They're sort of sandwiched together with this unusual one in between. But the other two were blind men that Jesus had healed. One in chapter 8, one in chapter 10. And it's really telling us something about true sight and spiritual blindness. And the disciples have seen, but they haven't yet fully seen. And now they've tried and failed to rescue this boy. And there's going to need to be something that we discover here about faith and sight with that. Augustine said that the world says seeing is believing, but actually the Bible teaches that believing is seeing. And so there's lots to see here about a frail faith in a very strong saviour. So we'll firstly unpack this opening scene. We saw last week that the pathway to glory lies through a valley, and that's a picture of that here. And so first up, we see that Jesus enters our chaos. A trip down a mountain is sometimes actually harder than going up. I've learnt that before. When we hiked up Mount Bogong a few years ago, there was a really spectacular view at the top, but then came the trip back down when I was tired and hungry. And you might have had a time when you've had a mountaintop experience with God and then gone straight into a valley. And that's what Jesus faced here. He's just had this incredible moment with Peter, James and John. And no sooner does he descend the mountain when he's faced with all the messy complexity of life once again. The troubled world below is in disarray. And it's just like arriving at work on a Monday morning after a long weekend. you know, the printer is jammed, your clients are all unhappy, and everyone is looking to you to fix it all. It's chaos. And here there is sickness, evil, conflict, confusion, despondency, and desperation. It's a foggy sea of unbelief. And so there's this argument between the other nine disciples and the Jewish leaders. If you look at verse 14, the scribes. That is an ominous interaction. They were meant to be the theological guardians, the Bible college lecturers, supposed experts in the law, and they've taken advantage of the fact that Jesus wasn't there, and they are not interested in helping this boy. They would rather have a theological debate, and they're taking these deflated disciples to task, pointing out their failings, questioning their authority, and just using this situation for their agenda. That cold-hearted religious legalism will always fail to provide any meaningful treatment for a genuine spiritual problem. There is no attempt by them to help the Father or to deal with any underlying cause. So it's really just about keeping up appearances. And it's terrible, toxic religion. There's an insight for you and me too, that the problem with the world isn't always from an atheistic worldview. There is highly religious people who reject Jesus as well. And actually they will throw the boot in whenever possible. They'll jump at the chance to attack Jesus' followers and then pretend they've got all the answers. So the crowd surrounds Jesus, and we, in a sense, we're participating with the crowd to see how Jesus will handle all this situation. And how about these disciples who had tried and failed and ended up in an argument instead? We could say at least they've attempted something. Only a few pages back, if you look back in Mark 6, Jesus had sent out the disciples to proclaim the gospel, to heal people and then deliver people from evil. And this verse in Mark 6 says that they cast out many demons and healed lots of people. And disciples would be thinking to themselves, what is going on here? Why is this not the same as before? So the crowd all run up to Jesus in verse 15. They put him on the spot. And then he asks, what's going on? But the scribes don't get to respond to that. The boy's father, at the centre of all this attention, whose son has been suffering terribly. So verse 17, someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." Great respect for Jesus. He calls him teacher. He shows awareness. He understands that this is a spiritual issue going on. He shows a sense of expectation. He knows that Jesus can somehow help, but there's also desperation and devastation that the disciples haven't been able to help. Now, I know there's some medical professionals in the building today, and they would be able to tell you more about seizures. They might call it a tonic-clonic seizure. People can often scream, lose consciousness, their muscles go into contractions, and it can be caused by a head trauma or a serious infection, more commonly by epilepsy. But we need to see that this is more than that. And the New Testament isn't being primitive here. It does make a distinction. C.S. Lewis writes about our historical or chronological snobbery, I think he calls it, thinking that we as modern humanity are the ones who are more advanced in every way, morally, socially, even theologically. But what if we are the ones who are ignorant in this space? What if we are uninformed and unenlightened about the spiritual realm and its impact on this world? What if we've tried to explain everything scientifically, but left a gaping hole in our understanding of anything of that world beyond. Do you remember last week we looked at the sneak peek into Jesus' divinity, that realm beyond, that curtain was open at the transfiguration. And what's happening here is just another display of that spirit world that actually impacts the physical. You can see the results of it. And we're going to need to understand what this means for you and me. For now, I really want us to reflect on the fact that you and I need Jesus. We need his help. And without him, there's just anarchy and heartache and chaos. Whether that's spiritual or relational or moral or emotional, all of the things that we try and seek after to fix in this world will fall short without Jesus. And the devil will wreak havoc, and sin and sickness and Satan are all around. The foggy sea of unbelief is a real thing in our world. So there's this amazing response from Jesus, and what he says and teaches about that we'll need to learn from. And we'll need to explore the nature of faith and then the application of this declaration from the Father that just rings so true, doesn't it? I believe, help my unbelief. And in Alice in Wonderland, I don't know if you know it, but Lewis Carroll records a little conversation between Alice and the Queen of Hearts. The Queen tells Alice her age, but Alice doesn't believe it. And there's no use trying, she said. One can't believe impossible things. And the Queen says, I dare say you haven't had much practice. When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Now, we need to understand that faith isn't that. It's not believing in something that you're completely unconvinced about and just switching your brain off. Every one of us lives by faith. If you drive across a bridge, you're trusting that to support you and your car and all the other cars and trucks and buses on the bridge. And that's really about a quality thing, not a quantity thing. The bridge's effectiveness isn't tied to how much you trust in it. It can support you even if you just trust it a little bit. And life is like a series of acts of faith. It's constant. No matter how sceptical or self-reliant you think you are exercising faith, even in sitting in that chair right now. You're trusting that I haven't come along with my screwdriver and undone, you know, a few things underneath. I don't think they work like that, but you can trust me that I haven't rigged these chairs. I haven't sawn one of the legs slightly. I think you can trust me not to do that. But the faith that's being described here is more than wishful thinking. And the Bible actually says that. Psalm 9 verse 10 says, we trust because we know. Those who know your name put their trust in you. So it's not a blind faith, and you don't need to dumb down, and you don't leave your brain at the door. I've heard someone say, it doesn't matter what you believe in as long as you have faith. That is not true. It does matter what you believe in. It matters who that faith is in. And it's not about your power and your resources. It's about the object of your faith. So being saved by grace through faith, that is something not from us. And Jesus is the author and perfecter of our faith. So that means he writes the story of faith into your life. So let me ask you, what do you think this story is about? Is this just another passage about exorcism and the ability for us to exorcise demons? Or is this a passage about the ability of your faith to do anything that you want? Is it about just having enough faith? We'll explore that. Think of this young boy suffering. This is really a horrifying experience of evil. It's not an everyday experience. This is peculiar. And we need to beware the extremes when it comes to this sort of thing. There's either naive denial of the underworld, which will leave us deluded. That's on the one hand. But on the other extreme, there can be an unhealthy obsession. And see, you can start seeing Satan behind every bush that you walk past. evil does exist, and the Bible calls you and me to stand against the devil's lies and resist him, and he'll flee from you. But it doesn't say that every sickness has a spiritual reason like this. Demons are not always involved. If you think about Jesus in Matthew 25, he said, "When I was sick, you cared for me, or you visited me. Not when I was sick, you exorcised me." And so, same in James chapter 5. It says, if anyone is sick, then pray. Call the elders to pray for you, not to exorcise you. So this boy may well have had epilepsy, but it's a problem that's exacerbated by this demon. And look at the detail. The fact that he's thrown into the fire and water is part of the symptoms described, and that's not random. So no one's been able to help. I mean, it's the first century, so there's no Medicare safety net involved. But Jesus responds in verse 19. Have a look at what he says here. When he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" And that's really a diagnosis that isn't directed at the Father or at the disciples. It's actually broader than that. It's directed to the crowd and certainly the scribes that are there. And so this exasperated cry of how long is just similar to when God lamented them. It would happen later when Jesus arrives in Jerusalem before he went to the cross. He lamented that they'd killed the prophets and they wouldn't listen. It's raw and it's real. It's just this other insight into who Jesus really is. He's God in the flesh who has come into this world. And so he can reflect like this from acting. And they bring the boy to him, verse 20, when the spirit saw him, immediately convulsed the boy, fell on the ground, rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Now, that's just another proof of the spiritual oppression that this boy is facing. It's in the presence of Jesus now that this spirit tries once again to destroy this, come out to meet Jesus. And the demon tries to degrade this boy's very humanity, his image bearing, which the devil hates. And so he tries to destroy him without mercy. And he would dehumanize this boy. That's his MO. But Jesus asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood, and he's often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. Now that suggests why these parents had concluded that this was a spiritual thing. Just imagine this for that father. No bonfires allowed. No beach trips, just to access to those things. Fire and water are essential, aren't they? Every dad here is like, yeah. So both cooking and washing would prove very difficult as well. It would be cold nights and thirsty days every time his son's life was on the line. So he says, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. That's just showing us the father's suffering along with this son. It's plural there. On us, help us. Possibly his mum's included in that cry. The GoFundMe page hasn't worked. He's sought Jesus and he's been disappointed by the followers of Jesus. And we meet people like that, don't we? And his hopes are dashed and he's at the end of his rope. This man is about to discover that in Jesus there is an inexhaustible source of power. So Jesus says to him, if you can, all things are possible for the one who believes. What do you mean, if you can? Of course I can. The problem isn't with me, it's with you. And so we need to be careful here. Beware of the Disney idea that there can be miracles when you believe. It's like the worst song in the entire Disney repertoire, isn't it? If that belief doesn't involve Jesus, it might as well be make-believe. And same with the idea of telling the universe what you want from it, naming and claiming, manifesting. This isn't that. Jesus turns the issue back to the Father. It's not a problem in him. It's really the question of whether this man believes in Jesus or not. Do you take him at his word? Can you rely on his character and his love and who he really is? And isn't it fascinating? This man cries out. He screams it out, actually. I believe. Help my unbelief. And doesn't that resonate? It's amazingly honest. It's probably one of the most transparent people in the Bible. It's a cry of genuine faith. I do believe. Help my unbelief. But what does it mean? Well, some people would say that faith isn't about having it all together, being able to assent to every single doctrine, recite every catechism, or it's just about a simple faith despite some doubts. Now, that can be true, but it's not the whole picture. This isn't a mental assent to a list of doctrines. It's actually a cry from his heart, and Jesus can see that. What this definitely isn't is a kind of work. This isn't teaching that you need to crank up your faith enough up to the right level to then be accepted by Jesus. And we need to beware the conclusion that you need to have more faith to be healed or attain a certain level of faith to be accepted by Jesus. This father even brings his unbelief to Jesus. And that is the right way to bring it. It's the right direction for that. So this is the cry of a drowning man who is just sticking his hand up in a sea of unbelief, waving for Jesus. And that's the picture. Barnabas Piper has this little book called Help My Unbelief. It deals with the issue of how doubt isn't actually the enemy of faith. They can exist alongside each other. And he says this, thank God that our salvation is not dependent on the absence of our own fears, our failures, our doubts. In fact, our salvation is not dependent on us at all. It doesn't depend on how you feel or how well you answer challenges and questions. And the irony here is that this admission of unbelief comes as a genuine expression of true faith. And John Calvin said this, these two statements might appear to contradict each other, but actually there's none of us that doesn't experience both of them. Because our faith is never perfect, it follows that we are partly unbelievers. But God forgives us and exercises such forbearance towards us as to reckon us believers on account of just a small portion of faith. So you can pray this prayer as well. I believe, help my unbelief. Pray that when you are facing the chaos, whether it's family or work or grappling with this fallen world or suffering. And we're going to get a front row seat just in this last section of what Jesus can and does do. Look at verse 25 with me. When Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose. And that is a picture of salvation. It is the reality of your own affliction. You're under the power of the ruler of this world, in sin, in sickness, in helplessness. And look at the language that Mark uses here. That is deliberate. Jesus raises up the boy. It's like resurrection. And it's an enacted parable of what he does in salvation, of what Jesus does for you and me through his cross and resurrection. This declares his power over sin and sickness and Satan. And that's why he came. That same compassion that this father had pleaded for is the same compassion that Jesus shows for you and me when you put your trust in him. And the Psalms are full of these declarations about the Lord's compassion. The Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in faithful love. The Lord is gracious and righteous. Our God is compassionate. See, he is able to handle your burdens. And so you need to see just how trapped you are in the chaos of this world and see how completely hopeless you are alone, utterly lost in that sea of unbelief. And you cannot rescue yourself. You need Jesus. And he says, come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. See, that isn't just for people who are tired and upset. It's not like, you know, good to know, Jesus, thanks, I'll just be over here. That is for every single one of us. And the burden of your sin is too much for you to bear. You are in Satan's clutches until Jesus releases you and frees you. And we're just part of the faithless generation until you find your rest in him. So in these last couple of verses, Jesus then shows compassion even on the failed disciples. So his earlier question was he deflects and he gets the attention away from them. That is merciful in their moment of failure. But he doesn't chastise them. Their inability is only a limitation. And it's an opportunity for them to learn. And he addresses their question in private. If you look, verse 28, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. Some of the older translations used to say prayer and fasting. That's probably an addition to it. You'll see a footnote in most Bibles on that. Tim Keller says this, that those disciples had been trying to exorcise a demon, but they'd been trying to exorcise it without praying. How arrogant, how clueless they were about their own inadequacy to deal with the suffering and evil of this world. So the disciples tried prayerless exorcism for the same reason that they couldn't understand why Jesus had to die. They didn't see how weak and proud they were. They underestimated the power of evil in this world and in themselves. So not only do you need the eyes of faith to see Jesus, you need to be able to properly understand yourself and see your own great need. So both faith and prayer declare that spiritual power isn't from within you. It's found in him. Faith and prayer trust in his promises, in his abilities. And this says my inadequacy is then a reason to pray, to walk with and fellowship with the Lord by talking to him and asking for his help and relying on him to intervene and guide and comfort and sustain me. He is compassionate. He knows you. He knows your prayerlessness. It's like the silence is deafening, but he still loves you. He delights in you, and he came so that you might have freedom and hope in your life. And just to finish with, I found this old hymn that a group called Indelible Grace came up with a new version of it, and I've put it on the website if you're interested in listening to it. But just the first verse really struck me. Isaac Watts, he was a prolific hymn writer. He's got about 750 other songs as well. He says this, how sad our state by nature is, our sin, how deep it stains. And Satan binds our captive minds fast in his slavish chains. But there's a voice of sovereign grace that sounds from the sacred word, O ye despairing sinners, come and trust upon the Lord. Would you pray with me? Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. We pray that you might encourage each person here today to cry that out to you in their heart of hearts, that we would let go of our religiosity and learn what faith really is. Help us to trust you at your word, to walk in your ways, to learn from you and grow as your disciples. We thank you for being a compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love for those you came to save. Lord, would you forgive our arrogance, our apathy, our prayerlessness? May we trust you for who you are and keep on discovering that. And we pray that in Jesus' name.